Well, on Sunday mornings, we're going through the Psalms. We're looking at each psalm in turn. We're reading it. We're singing it. We're meditating on it. And we're asking what each psalm meant for the people who first sang it. And we're asking what each psalm means for us today. And this morning, we've come to Psalm 107, which is, I might say, one of my very favourite psalms. It's a wonderfully happy psalm. It's full of thanksgiving and joy. Now, when was it written? Well, just like the previous psalm, Psalm 106, this psalm was obviously written after the Israelites had returned from their exile in Babylon and all sorts of places across the Babylonian Empire. You remember, we've talked about how the Israelites, the Jewish people, started arriving back from exile in the year 538 BC. Well, in verse 2, the psalmist urges the people whom the Lord had redeemed to speak out. The people whom he'd redeemed from trouble and gathered in from the lands, from the east and from the west and from the north and from the south. So this was written shortly after the people who had been scattered to the four winds had made their way back to Jerusalem. But I think it must have been written a bit later than the previous psalm, Psalm 106. In Psalm 106, the first returners had only been home a little while. They were still crying out, "Save us, O Lord our God! Gather us from among the nations!" You remember that in Psalm 106, verse 47. But when this psalm, Psalm 107, was written, things had moved on. The songwriter pictures the exiles establishing a city to dwell in. And they sow fields and they plant vineyards and they get a fruitful yield. By God's blessing, they multiply greatly and he doesn't let their stock diminish. That's all in verses 36 to 38. Or again in verse 41, he raises up the needy out of affliction and he makes their families like flocks. Do you see? The exiles are back in their own land, but they're no longer living in the ruins of the cities that had been destroyed half a century earlier. And they've been able to establish cities, to rebuild them. They're no longer looking at devastated farms that have been neglected for 50 years and are overgrown. They've had the opportunity to bring the fields back from the wild. They've been able to sow their crops and to get a harvest. They've planted vineyards and they've already started harvesting the grapes. Their herds and their flocks are increasing. Their families are growing up. It's a time of stability, contentment, fruitfulness, happiness, at least for the majority of them. These people have come back from exile and now they're rooted back in their own land and they're enjoying it. The song must have been sung on some great occasion when the exiles who had returned home were gathered together. It may have been a one-off celebration and called to thank God for what he'd done for them. Or it may have been one of the annual festivals. There were three held every year. And given the reference in verse 37 to the fruitful harvest, I think it was probably first sung at the Feast of Tabernacles, the feast that was held each autumn to celebrate the gathering in of the harvest. We know it must have been sung at some mass gathering because at point after point in the psalm, people are urged to give thanks for what God's done for them. In verse 2, it's all those whom the Lord has redeemed, who are supposed to speak out. And then, as you go on through the psalm, different groups in turn are given the opportunity to tell everyone else what God's done for them. So, verse 32, let them extol him, let them extol the Lord in the congregation of the people, and praise him in the assembly of the elders. So this psalm was written to give people the opportunity to sing out what God had done for them. And they were supposed to sing it out in front of the whole congregation of the people, the great gathering of the Israelites. And they were supposed to sing it out in front of the elders, the leaders of the nation. It's a psalm for public worship. And in this psalm, different groups of people are invited, they're summoned, they're commanded to sing out what the Lord has done for them. Now, the psalm falls into three sections. The first is a short prelude, which runs from verse 1 through to verse 3. The second runs from verse 4 through to verse 32. And the third runs from verse 33 through to the end. I'm only going to take you this morning through the first section of the psalm. Let's use our imagination again. You're not sitting in your own home this morning, staring at a computer screen on your own or with a handful of family members around you. You're standing in a crowd of many thousands of people. Men, women, children, and they're all in a festive mood. They've dressed up for the occasion. Many of them are in all white outfits. You wouldn't dream of wearing white on a working day, would you? But these people are on holiday together. Many of the people in the crowd are carrying palm branches, and they're waving them vigorously in the sunshine. In the background, you can see a half-finished building. It's going to be the temple building when it's completed. I mean, that's still quite a long way away. It's going to be some years before the temple is completely rebuilt. But you can see that the builders have made a lot of progress since you were here this time last year. And when you look around this city, you can see that building work's been going on everywhere. And there's a line of new shops that have been built down there. And some new houses have gone up over there. And there's a more impressive building that's underway down that street. It must be the new town hall where the city council are going to meet. You live, let's say, on a farm 20 miles or so from Jerusalem. But you've come into the city to celebrate the harvest feast. Many of the people who are here have actually live in Jerusalem. Lots more, like yourself, have come in from the countryside around. And there are some new arrivals, people who didn't come back from exile straight away when the opportunity first came, but have made their own way back since. It's a very mixed crowd that you've got all around you. It's obviously mixed in terms of age and sex, but it's mixed in lots of other ways as well. There are people from lots of different places in the Babylonian Empire where they've been forced to live. They differ in what sort of life they had while they were in exile. Some of them were literally slaves. Others of them may have had quite a comfortable life in exile. It's mixed in terms of how hard or how straightforward the journey had been to get back from exile. People are mixed in terms of how well things had gone for them since they arrived back in their own country. All the folk in this crowd are different from one another. But you've all come together now. because you've all got something to give thanks to God for. Well, this meeting is scheduled to start at, let's say, noon. And there's only a minute or two to go. The sun's almost exactly overhead. I'm being told that we have some sort of tech problem. Pardon me a moment. We don't know how severe the problem is. We don't actually know whether any of you are able to see me or hear me. But I'm going to carry on in the hope that you can, and hopefully somebody will send us a text or phone us to let us know what the state of play is. Let's carry on. I've tried to paint the picture of this great gathering in the city of Jerusalem, a city that's in the process of being rebuilt. Pictured somebody's doing as I've asked and phoning us. Good. I've pictured the people in the crowd in their festive clothes. A very mixed group of people in that crowd. I've pictured some of the different circumstances that make them different from one another. I hope you've got that picture in your mind of this huge crowd who have gathered together there in Jerusalem. The meeting that they're attending is due to start at 12 o'clock, midday. And there's only a minute or two to go. The sun is almost exactly overhead now. And the crowd begins to quieten down. And then suddenly there's a deafening clang of cymbals being clashed together, and there's a great peal of trumpets, and you see two columns of men walking up to the platform that's set in front of the crowd, and one group are carrying the trumpets and one group are carrying the cymbals. As they reach the platform, one group fills up the left-hand side and the other group fills up the right-hand side. You know who these people are. This is the choir, and it's made up of priests and Levites. And you can see standing facing them the worship leader, the chief musician, the conductor. You've heard rumours that he's written a new psalm especially for this occasion. So we're all ready now. We're waiting. The trumpeters lift their trumpets to their lips. The cymbalists raise their cymbals. There's another long trumpet peal. There's another deafening clash of cymbals. There's a moment of silence. And then the half of the choir on the left sing out the great traditional call to worship. Give thanks to the Lord, for he is good. And the choir on the right sing out the reply, "For his steadfast love endures forever." And those are very familiar words. All the people in the crowd have heard that summons and that reply so many times before. It's part of so many of the Psalms. The very last Psalm we looked at, Psalm 106, begins with those words. And then the choir, facing you all, sings out a great invitation. They sing it in unison. "Let the redeemed of the Lord say so." You understand the word redeemed? It means rescued. It means set free. But more than that, it means set free at great cost. It's the word that would normally be used if, let's say, one of your relatives had become a slave, and then you went and did what a family member should be willing to do. You went and you bought them out of slavery, and you paid whatever needed to be paid to do that. You redeemed them. Well, all the people in that crowd had been slaves in Babylon. Not all of them would have been officially classed as slaves, but they were all slaves in practice because they had no freedom. They couldn't leave Babylon. But the Lord had redeemed them. Because this nation was his special chosen nation, because it was his family, the Lord had stepped in and he'd set them free, and he paid a great price to do it. He'd raised up a conqueror called Cyrus, and he'd handed whole nations over to Cyrus in order for the Israelites to be set free. Well, now the choir is reminding all the people in that crowd that they were the redeemed of the Lord. They were the people whom the Lord had rescued. He'd brought them out of slavery. He'd set them free. And the choir sings, "If you're the redeemed of the Lord, then this is the moment to speak out. Let the redeemed of the Lord say so." Say what? Well, I think it must mean that they're to shout out the words that the choir has just sung. That familiar cry, "His steadfast love endures forever." They've spoken and they've sung those words many times before. But now they've got to say them with new meaning. Why? Because the Lord has given them new evidence of his steadfast love. What is it? It's the fact that he's redeemed them. And then the left-hand choir comes in to remind them what they've been redeemed from. Whom he's redeemed from trouble. And the right-hand choir follows by singing where they'd been redeemed from. Gathered in from the lands. And the left-hand choir points to the east and sings, "From the east." And then with the other arm to the west and sings, "And from the west." And the right-hand choir points to the north, "From the north." And then to the south, "And from the south." And then everybody in that crowd does just what they've been told to. They break out with a great shout, "His love endures forever." Why? Because they're the people who have been redeemed. They're the people who have been gathered in from all the lands. They've been brought from east and west and south and north. They know from their own experience that the Lord's steadfast love is forever, because God has proved his steadfast love for them. He's redeemed them. It was the one thing they all had in common. They'd come from different directions, from east and west and north and south, and they'd had very different experiences. As the psalm goes on, we'll see the choir singing about different groups in the crowd and the different things that the Lord had done for them. Verse 4, some had been wandering in desert wastelands. Verse 10, some had been sitting in darkness and the shadow of death. Verse 14, some were fools through their sinful ways and had sunk into deep depression. Verse 23, some had gone down to the sea in ships and faced terrifying storms. So different people in that crowd had been rescued from very different nasty situations. But they'd all had this in common. They were slaves, enslaved by a terrible tyrant, the Emperor of Babylon, forced to submit to his laws, subject to his whims, his cruel decrees. They'd been scattered throughout his lands, far from their rightful home, far from their own inheritance, far from their own land, far from the holy city. But now they'd been redeemed. They were free because the Lord Yahweh had set them free. He'd taken pity on them. He'd acted to save them. He'd paid the price that had to be paid for their freedom. He brought them back from all the places where they'd been scattered. He brought them back to the place that was made for them. And he brought them together. So when the choir sang, "Let the redeemed of the Lord say so," I'm sure they all shouted out, "Yes, it's true. His steadfast love endures forever." I'm sure they shouted it till the ground shook. Some of them, I'm sure, were finding life back in their homeland was hard. I don't suppose they all had perfect health. I don't suppose that they'd all had an equally good harvest. I don't suppose all of them had perfect marriages or perfectly behaved children. Some of them will have had more than their fair share of problems over the previous 12 months. But they're still the redeemed of the Lord. And they've got to say so. If they've been redeemed by Yahweh, they know that whatever their present struggles, his steadfast love does go on forever. And that fact should thrill their hearts. It's bigger than all their ongoing circumstances and all their problems. The psalmist wants them to say it, his steadfast love endures forever. Well, I asked you to use your imagination, and I hope you have done. And I hope that in your imagination you can see that crowd of people there in Jerusalem at that great festival. They're being reminded of the one great thing that the Lord had done for all of them. He'd redeemed them. They were the redeemed of the Lord. And that moves them to remember his steadfast love and to speak of it, to sing of it, to shout about it. Let's keep using our imagination. Most of you who are listening this morning, I'm sure, are members of the church in Stockport. So let's imagine the first Lord's Day, that we meet again, not like this through electronic gadgetry that goes wrong, but when we're meeting together again in one place. I don't know how many of us there'll be there, and I don't know how far apart we'll be standing, but I know that we'll be a funny, mixed-up bunch of people, just as we always have been. Some of us will be elderly, and some of you will be young, and some of you will be there with a family, and some of you will be single, and some of you will be feeling healthy and strong, and others will be struggling with long-term medical conditions. Some of you will have been quite enjoying the months of lockdown, more free time, more opportunities for gardening. And others of you will have found it a complete nightmare. Some of you will feel that it's been a time for you of spiritual growth and joy. And others will feel that it's been a time of temptation and that you've fallen into sin again and again. We'll be coming together from different directions out of different circumstances. and I hope that we'll all be glad to be together again. I don't know who'll be leading that first service. It might be myself, or it might be Jeff, or it might be someone else. But let's imagine that whoever it is who leads that service were to start the service with the words of this psalm. Oh, give thanks unto the Lord, for he is good. His steadfast love endures forever. Let the redeemed of the Lord say so. What would you do at that moment? Would you say so? Would you shout out, yes, it's true, the Lord's steadfast love does endure forever. I know it's true because he's redeemed me. Would you feel that the Lord's steadfast love is something worth shouting about so that everyone else could hear you? Do you feel it's something worth shouting about this morning, where you are now in your own home? Does it seem wonderful to you that God's steadfast love for you endures forever? Does it seem wonderful that in that steadfast love he's redeemed you? Is the fact that you've been redeemed, is it bigger, is it more significant than all the good things or the bad things of these past few weeks? Is it more important than lockdowns and furloughs and Zoom meetings and cancelled hospital appointments and social distancing and all the rest of the things that we're talking about all the time? Are you saying to yourself, I've been rescued, I've been redeemed, I'm free, and it's wonderful. That means that his steadfast love for me, it's forever. If you are a real Christian this morning, you have been redeemed. Do you know what I mean when I talk about a real Christian? It means that you're someone in whose life a miracle has happened. God, the one infinite being who rules the whole universe, has had personal dealings with you. God spoke to you, not in an audible voice, but still in a way that you couldn't mistake. And he showed you the truth about yourself. He showed you the frightening, painful truth that you were a bad person, that you'd done evil things, things that were against his will. He showed you that you had a bad heart, a heart that naturally steered you towards doing bad things. In Bible language, he showed you that you were a sinner. He made you feel wretched about your sinfulness. He made you feel guilty and ashamed. But God didn't leave you in that state. He showed you that his own Son, the Lord Jesus, was able to rescue you from your sin. He pulled you irresistibly towards Jesus Christ. And he brought you to the point where you were ready to trust Jesus to save you from your sin, and to trust Jesus for everything else as well. And you did. You put yourself into the hands of Jesus Christ forever. So now you're trusting Jesus Christ totally. He's become your saviour, your master, your Lord. He's more important to you than anyone else in all the world. Does that description fit you? What I've described, has that happened to you? If the answer's yes, then what that means is that you're a real Christian. And what that means is that you've been redeemed. And that means that you've got something to shout about this morning. Something that should move you to thanksgiving and rejoicing. You know that the Lord's steadfast love endures forever, and you're one of the people whom he loves with that steadfast love. And the reason you know it is because you've been redeemed. Let me list out three reasons why to be redeemed is such a wonderful thing. It's wonderful, firstly, because of what you've been redeemed from. You've been redeemed. You've been rescued from an infinitely worse situation than the Israelites were in when they were slaves in Babylon. They were slaves of a wicked tyrant, the emperor of Babylon. They were part of his evil empire. But you were a member of the real empire of evil. You were a member of the empire that's headed up by Satan himself. You were a subject of that cruel, proud, ancient enemy of God, the enemy of everything that's good. You were Satan's servant, even though you almost certainly never realized it or thought about it. The way you lived your life was the way he wanted you living your life. The values you clung to were the values he wanted you to have. Your priorities, your choices were the ones that he instilled into you. For some of you, that meant doing things that were obviously gross and wicked. I don't suppose it meant that for most of you. It just meant living the way other people lived. Maybe you even lived a bit better than most of them. Maybe that you really tried to be a decent person. But basically, you wanted your life to be pleasant, happy, fulfilled, you wanted to be well respected, you had your work, you had your family, you had your friends, you just got on with things. The person who lives like that is living the way that Satan wants them to live. Just as much as the person who lives an obviously wicked life. Satan is really happy when he sees people just living for the good things of this world, providing that they carry on pushing God out to the sidelines. For they don't make God their first priority. For that they don't worship God as the supremely important one. For that they don't love God with all their heart. Now, can you remember living like that? Living every day without God. Living without his love and his friendship. Living far away from him. Maybe that the life you lived back then was fairly stable and felt okay. You don't miss what you've never had. It may be that the life you lived back then was utter misery. But whichever way it was, looking back on it now, you say, oh, it's horrible that I ever lived like that. How could I have lived without God? How could I have lived without knowing him, without experiencing his love, without loving him? The things you took for granted back then, now when you look on them, they seem so empty, so gross, so awful. You look back now and you think of your life before you became a Christian as such an empty, selfish, wicked life. But, and this is the amazing thing, that's not your life now, is it? You've been set free. You've been redeemed. Peter put it this way in his first letter. We read it at the beginning. You have been redeemed from the empty way of life handed down to you from your forefathers. You've been set free from the slavery you once lived in. You've been set free from an empty way of life separated from God. You've been set free from your sin, from your self-centered, guilty life. You might have all sorts of problems today. You may be depressed living in lockdown. You might be feeling terribly lonely. You might be struggling with all sorts of frightening thoughts about what's going to come next. You may have some painful illness or be struggling with some temptation that you don't think you could ever tell anybody else about. But you're not in the situation in which you were when God rescued you. You're not still a slave of Satan and sin. You're not still separated from God. You're not still carrying the burden of unforgiven sin. You've been redeemed. You've been rescued. And that's the first thing that should fill you with thanksgiving and joy. When you remember your slavery, the slavery you've been redeemed from, a slavery you could never have escaped from by your own efforts. If you've been redeemed from all of that, it is only because of God's steadfast love. And then the second thing is this. When you remember what you've been redeemed for, the people who first heard this psalm being sung, they've been rescued, they've been set free from their slavery in Babylon, but it hadn't ended there. God had redeemed them from Babylon so that he could bring them to their own land, to an inheritance, to somewhere where there could be safety and peace, a place where they could be together, a place where they could enjoy God's love, a place where they could love one another and be loved by one another, a place where they could live in freedom and worship God freely. None of those things had been possible while they were slaves in Babylon. But God had redeemed them. God had brought them out so that they could have something infinitely worth having. They hadn't yet got everything they dreamed of. They hadn't yet got everything God had intended for them. But they were already beginning to enjoy these wonderful gifts from God. Well, again, I've got to say that if you're a real Christian, if you've been redeemed, then it means that God has brought you out from your old life, your life of slavery, to enjoy something more wonderful than you could ever have imagined. He redeemed you so that you could become his child through Jesus Christ, so that you could become a member of God's own family. Paul says in Galatians that you were redeemed so that you might receive the full rights of sons, God's sons. God redeemed you so that you might become his heir. Everything God is and everything that God has is going to belong to you, and it will belong to you forever. God redeemed you so that his life could be joined to yours, and so that your life could be joined to his, so that his own being, his own spirit, could come and live in you. He's there now, living in your body, living in your brain and in your soul. God himself is living in you now. And that's the guarantee that you're going to receive the full inheritance. And because God's Spirit is living in you, that means that you're linked together with all the other people whom God has redeemed, because they've got God's Spirit living in them as well. Just as God redeemed those Jewish people and brought them together from east and west and north and south and made them into a single community, he's brought you into the most wonderful community, the most wonderful family that's ever existed or will exist, the family of God's ransomed children. So you, with all your problems and all your doubts and all your struggles with sin and all your disappointments and all your frustrations and your fears, you now already are a member of the royal family of the universe. You've been given God's own life, eternal life in your soul, so that you can never die. You've begun to experience what it is to live as a child of God, in the family of God. You're loved by God and you're loved by all the other members of the family. And you've got angels as your servants and you've got the universe as your inheritance. That's what God redeemed you for. He brought you out from being one of Satan's pawns to being one of his own precious children. When you say, I'm redeemed, that's what you're saying. Isn't it a wonderful thing to be able to say, I'm redeemed? It means that you're loved by God and you're loved by him forever. His steadfast love for you will never end. And then thirdly, let me give you a third thing that should fill you with joy and thanksgiving. When you remember what it cost God to redeem you. You remember I said at the beginning that that's what redeem means? It means to rescue somebody, to set them free by paying a price. In Bible times, if your brother had become a slave, you'd have to pay a price to redeem him from slavery. If your child had been captured and become a prisoner of war, you'd have to pay a price to redeem him and get him back. And of course, the more you loved your brother or your child or your friend, the higher the price you'd be willing to pay to redeem him. God had paid a high price to rescue these people who were worshipping in Jerusalem, to rescue them from slavery, to bring them into their inheritance. The Lord said in the book of Isaiah that he'd handed over whole nations to buy back the Israelites. He said, I give Egypt for your ransom. I give Cush and Seba in your stead. Since you're precious and honored in my sight and because I love you, I will give men in exchange for you. I will give people in exchange for your life. To redeem the Israelites from their slavery in Babylon, God had had to hand over countless people to the power of King Cyrus. Well, what price did God pay to redeem you from your life of slavery and to make you one of his children and to give you your inheritance? It was an awesome price. It was a price that none of us can calculate. Listen, this is Peter's first letter again. It was not with perishable things, such as silver and gold, that you were redeemed from the empty way of life handed down to you from your forefathers. You were redeemed with the precious blood of Christ. For you to be set free, somebody had to die. God's own Son had to die. Jesus Christ, God's one perfect, sinless Son, had to die the most dreadful death imaginable. His blood was the price for your freedom. God had to send his own Son, whom he loved, who was more precious to him than a million universes could ever be. He had to send him into this world. And he had to hand his own Son over to evil men. And then God had to stand back while those men beat his son into a pulp and spat on him and tortured him to death. God had to watch as his son was crucified. God had to listen as his son cried out in bewilderment and hurt, and God didn't lift a finger to help him. God didn't intervene. Jesus cried out to God his Father, "My God, why have you forsaken me?" And God didn't answer. He turned away and left his son dying in loneliness, broken, in agony of body and mind. God treated his own son as if he were a criminal, as if he were his enemy, as if he were the most evil person in the world. And why did God treat his son Jesus in that way? He did it because Jesus was taking your place. He was taking the punishment that your sins deserve. He was dying for you. And that was the price God paid to redeem you, to set you free from your slavery, to buy you back for himself. He gave up his son, and it broke his heart. That's how highly he valued you. That's how much he loved you. In order to win you back from being one of Satan's subjects, in order to make you a member of his family, in order to have the right to share his inheritance with you, he gave his own son to die on that cross. Jesus Christ's blood was the price of your redemption. Dearly you're loved, highly esteemed, redeemed with Jesus' blood, redeemed. To be one of God's redeemed people is the most wonderful thing in the world. When you think about what you were, a slave of sin and Satan, when you think about what you are, a child of God, God's heir, sharing God's own life, and when you think about the price that God was willing to pay to redeem you, shouldn't you be thrilled? Shouldn't you be awed? Shouldn't you be exultant? Shouldn't you be shouting for joy? It means that you're loved with a love that can never end, a love that would pay any price, an infinite love. His steadfast love endures forever. I ask you to imagine the scene at that great festival in Jerusalem, where this psalm was first sung, where the cry went up for the first time, "Let the redeemed of the Lord say so." And then I ask you to imagine the scene when we meet again to worship God together as his redeemed children. I hope that when we come together then, we will all be thrilled by the fact that we're God's redeemed children and that his love for us endures forever. But finally, let me ask you to imagine one more scene. The scene when all God's redeemed children from all nations, from all centuries, meet for the great festival. The festival that goes on forever. The festival round the throne where our God sits with his son Jesus at his right hand. At last the work of redemption will be complete. At last we'll have entered into everything that the Lord redeemed us for. And you know, the cry will go up again, Let the redeemed of the Lord say it. I wonder how many millions of people will be shouting then, we're redeemed. His steadfast love does endure forever. If you're a real Christian, you'll be there in that crowd, shouting God's praises then. Shouldn't you be shouting them now? And if you're not one of God's real children, if you're not a real Christian, isn't it time that you began to seek him? Isn't it time that you confess to him that you're a sinner and that you need his power to redeem you? Isn't it time to seek the Lord?